Thank you, Paula. Before we turn it to the panel, I think as Paula suggested, I'll make a couple of comments about how we're sort of viewing this space and how important conversations like today are to our thinking. I think, as we've seen from some of the comments that Emma made, there's huge benefits from AI, and quite often there's a tendency to sort of drift to this sort of alarmist conversation about what it's going to do to jobs and what it's going to mean for people's livelihood going forward, and what's the role of humanity in this. And again, this is why a conversation like today and the series that we've been undertaking with CEDA is really important. It's a little bit more nuanced than that. So if you look at the impact on jobs, as a good example, most of the research is showing that jobs aren't going to disappear, they're just going to change. And so a conversation about the role of humans in production and in labour is really important because those functions are going to change and they're going to adapt and they're going to need to adapt as automation and artificial intelligence comes in. And really good examples of that include, I'll give you an example of a project that we're working on with the Northern Territory Government. So it's very, very hard to go diving into some of the waters in around Darwin because they're croc infested. So if you want to do analysis of fish stocks in the harbour in Darwin, at the moment they've been using drones to do that. Now that's great, that captures a lot of footage, but then someone has to analyse that. So you're having people sit down, go through hours and hours of footage, and then documenting fish as they see the fish on the screen. Now if you can automate that, you're then allowing that person to do other roles and potentially probably more valuable roles than sitting there and watching hours and hours of fish footage. So thinking about how that sort of adapts, and I think in my role at Microsoft in public policy, focusing on some of those beneficials, but also acknowledging and being open and transparent about some of the risks of the technology. And I think Kirsten made some really, really good points about understanding bias. We all have biases. Acknowledging those biases, and that's where I think a lot of the focus on unconscious bias is really important, because if you understand those biases, then you can manage against them. And the risks are that if you don't acknowledge those biases, then you get an outcome that you feel confident in, but it inherently has some biases built into it. So, you know, as we're talking about including people in the processes, one of the things that we've learned at Microsoft is to be more inclusive in our feedback mechanisms. So ensuring that we have people of different backgrounds, people with disability involved in design and development. So we have an inclusive design process at Microsoft. We've seen some of the innovations. So one of the innovations that Emma spoke about, Seeing AI, was actually the idea of an engineer who was blind inside of Microsoft. We have another application which is called Soundscape, which is a navigation app. And again, that came from an engineer who was blind. One of the other great examples, we have added artificial intelligence to Skype and to Teams. So if anyone uses Skype for Business, we're starting to build automatic transcriptions. Now, where that started was actually around translation. So the Skype engineers were working on applications where one person who was speaking in one language could converse with another person in another language and have that translation done in largely real time. And so there's some great videos of school children in the US speaking to school children in Mexico in English to Spanish. What happened was we actually had a deaf engineer who was looking at that going, hang on, this is an automatic captioning service basically for me, which actually is really beneficial. And so he was able to then input into the engineers and say, well, hang on, have you thought about this use scenario? Can we make that work and can we make it better? And so that's why having people of different backgrounds inside your organisation and being inclusive in who you hire is really important going forward. And then also thinking about your feedback mechanisms, your customer service channels as well, and making sure they're inclusive. And one thing that we learnt through the development of Windows 10, Windows 10 was the first kind of crowdsourced open operating system that we developed. We had about 7 million people that were involved in the Insiders program who were providing us feedback as Windows 10 was developed on different functions. Those 7 million people tended to look and feel like a certain type of person, and it probably is no surprise to anyone that they are very technically literate and they are often Caucasian males of a certain age. So we were getting feedback, a lot of feedback, from a small group of society, we weren't getting that broad feedback. And so, not surprisingly, when Windows 10 launched, it had some challenges. So that's actually caused us to review a lot of our feedback. So we actually have created dedicated feedback channels for people with disabilities. So we have a user voice feedback channel, which actually is about functionality that people would like to see going forward built into our products. We have a dedicated channel for a customer service channel called the Disability Answer Desk, which is there for people with disabilities who use assistive technology. And the importance about that is that you have customer service officers who are trained in assistive technology, who understand the questions they're asking, and when they use terminology that refers to assistive technology, that they know what they're talking about and they know how to help them. And so those sort of feedback mechanisms are really important. And extending that to AI, unless you're taking data from the broadest possible sets, and unless those sets are reflective of society and reflective of humanity, you are going to be building biased systems. And I think acknowledging that and then managing against that is really critical as we go forward. So look, I'll turn to the panel, because I think you've probably heard enough from me. Look, I want to start off, start with something that Emma said, which is, Emma's an optimist, and I like to count myself as an optimist as well. But I think we need to look at both sides of the coin. So I'll ask the panelists, so maybe starting with Emma, and we'll go to Kirsten and go to Wayne. What's the best thing you're seeing from AI, and what's concerning you the most? So we'll start with the benefits and we'll go to the negatives.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, I've already talked about some of the benefits for me and for people who are blind or vision impaired personally, but obviously one of the big benefits I think we'll see in the not too distant future from my perspective is self-driving vehicles, because, you know, that would be great. Of course, and that then brings me to what worries me. What worries me is that something that has the potential to benefit me and others who are blind or vision impaired significantly may be stalled because people, society might not be ready. And might have what you referred to as the alarmist conversation, and therefore miss what I think is a significant opportunity. And I think one of the ways to deal with that issue is actually to address the issue of trust, because actually a lot of what we're talking about here is about our willingness to trust, you know, machine assisted thinking and learning. And I actually think that people with disability have a significant role to play in helping the rest of society get on board and build trust in technology and in our AI, because we have to trust humans every single day with all manner of bizarre things, to be honest. And, you know, people, we get taken advantage of occasionally, but the vast majority of humans are really good people. And so I think that and it's why I think in some cases people with disability are often early adopters of technology, because we do actually need the technology. We need to build that trust in order to get stuff done. So, I mean, I think, again, I am putting a positive spin on it, but I actually think that that's going to be a really key area for us to think about. How can we harness what people with disability and people from other diverse communities are already doing every day to help build trust in this technology as it evolves?
So I guess what I'm seeing that I really like is social media channels. They're actually starting to respond to public complaints and criticisms about what is being allowed to be disseminated through the channels. So you look at YouTube and, you know, starting to look for pornographic images that children shouldn't be seeing, including children themselves, terrorist groups are really active on Twitter and things like that. So I think that's really important that some of the bigger companies are starting to say we actually have to do something, and they can't sort of say we're just a tool anymore. They're really responsible for a lot of how we start to think about the world and how we share ideas. In terms of where things are potentially going wrong, I mean, I touched on it a little bit still, about the bias. I mean, it's just massively pervasive still. I think we're still all about, you know, how quickly can we add money to our bottom line rather than are we including everyone? I think it's a really big thing. There's a really important work being done around just race as well. So we've all experimented in our industry in computer vision with various face recognition algorithms and some that actually literally exclude black people. So if you can imagine, you know, trying to access, you know, an airport or whatever it is and you're black and you just don't get through, you know, it's absolutely incredible that these sorts of things actually slip through. So I think, you know, we've still got a long, long way to go to be fully inclusive.
Wayne?
I think interesting question, and you know, the response from me, I think, is really around the capabilities and some of the things that Emma has already flagged. You know, the accessibility aspects of what AI can do and machine learning can do, and you know, one of the things that I'm really interested in is actually the Microsoft captions, Skype caption, you know, as a mainstream alternative for people who need captions to be able to, you know, make remote calls, you know. So that's, you know, the idea that we can start seeing mainstream products that are utilizing machine learning to make those products accessible and usable by people with disabilities is a really fantastic outcome of AI. One of the concerns that I have around that is, you know, there's been a lot of research and a lot of there's a lot of knowledge about how AI and bias can impact, you know, gender, race, age. There's not a lot of information about how it really impacts people with disability. I think people with disability, you know, as much as many of us are very independent and, you know, live full and rich lives, despite our impairment, you know, we still are part of the fringe, and if we're not brought into this process and discussion and put central to what the outcomes are, there's going to be more disadvantage for people with disability, and we're going to be worse off as a result of AI. I mean, you know, just one of the things that in Kirsten's presentation, talking about the Amazon recruitment tool, you know, there's an application in the US called HireVue, which is, you know, people upload a video interview, and you know, AI assesses their suitability based on their appearance, their gestures, their voice, you know, and it just is like seems, well, that's just, you know, inevitably going to be dreadfully exclusive. You know, it's just, there's so many opportunities for that to work against people with disability, people with any kind of physical appearance difference, voice difference, just, you know, using gestures. You know, what happens with somebody who's an amputee and only has one arm, and, you know, what is the, how does that rate somebody like that for a job? And then, you know, how many different algorithms do you have? Do you use the same one for, you know, a bank manager as the one that you're using for, you know, an office secretary? There's so many problems with that, or potential problems with that, that, you know, it is really alarming.
Thanks, Wayne. I want to pick up on that point around bias, and maybe I'll ask Kirsten. You spoke quite a bit around managing bias, and what sort of good practices have you seen in terms of managing that bias, and particularly as AI becomes more pervasive, and a number of the members here today will be starting to experiment with AI in their own companies. What are some tips you can give them?
Yeah, I think you have to, like I said, build really good testing tools. Yep. So you actually can, you know, look at your data and actually assess on a continuum how comprehensive it is. So there was something else I was reading about age and gender, where they had a data set and it was literally 2 to 5% of pictures were female. So this is a massive data set that's supposed to be implemented broadly, and only 2% of the images are women. It's called like a pale male data set. So obviously it's going to exclude a lot of people, and that's very easy to manage. That's very easy to check and measure, and it's just simply no one's thinking about it. So I think it's exciting that there are some new policies that are, you know, being touted and talked about, EU, Australia, that sort of thing is really fantastic. But it's, Emma said it, I've said it, it's all about, you know, inclusive teams, and that includes sociologists, you know, all sorts of things, people who are actually, you know, accustomed to thinking, how do we help certain groups and ensure that they're actually represented, not just me, you know, thinking, you know, what can I think about? So even today, you know, talking to Emma and Wayne and going over and speaking to one of our engineers, it's how do we put some more inclusive tech in, you know, that actually makes it accessible not just to women and gender, you know, divisions, but actually, you know, everybody. So it's exciting. Thanks.
And actually, that's probably a good segue to Emma and Wayne. Well, I mean, what are some tips to ensure that the people with disability are represented and able to feed back into to organisations about design?
Yeah. I'll start if you like, Wayne. I think it's really important to establish the feedback mechanism before you start the design process. That's the first thing. So don't do it as an add-on at the end, because it's far too late, as I said in my presentation. I also think it works best when, you know, rather than making assumptions about what might work best, you actually ask people questions and actually talk with them. And talk, as I said, with a broad range of people from a broad range of you know, socioeconomic backgrounds, geographical locations, all of those things, as well as factoring in sort of, you know, the fact that they might have an impairment or, you know, be from a cold background or whatever. So it's that diversity of feedback. And I think it's also very, very important never to only use one mechanism when you're asking people to provide feedback. Because if, for example, you just use, a printed survey form, well, I'm not going to be helping you out with that one. On the other hand, if you just use, an electronic survey, then, you know, that can also cut out people, for example, who don't have good internet access. So you just always have to have multiple entry points for people to provide feedback and give people choice about how they do it, I think, is important.
Wayne, anything you'd like to add to that? Or
I think, you know, that what Emma said was really right on. I think, you know, perhaps one of the things that we need to really think about is the attitudinal changes that need to take place so that people, you know, in the design phase or the very early stages are actually thinking, you know, inclusively, so that they're able to actually, you know, go, okay, yes, we do need this and we do need that. We need to include all different sectors, you know, rather than, as Emma said, you know, there's a tendency to go, oh, well, we've got a blind person, that's fine, we've ticked that box, and do we need to test? No, that's fine, we've done that, so let's move on. So I think, you know, an attitudinal change is really important and necessary if we're going to make these sort of systemic changes so that they include everybody.
Fantastic. We're going to go to the floor. When you ask your question, can you just identify yourself by your name and your organisation? That'd be great. So we'll start here, and I think we have a question over the other side of the room after that.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
My name is Nilesh Makwana. I'm a CEO of Illuminant Solution, which is a shiny gold Microsoft partner.
Excellent. You're very welcome here.
Thank you. David, you may remember me, 2017, you funded our AvantCare product for disability sector under the Cloud for Global Good funding.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. It was a great initiative by Microsoft helping us working in disability sector, creating some good product which can have a social impact. And I understand that your CEO has a great vision when it comes to inclusive nature of Microsoft and making lives better for the people. And you have Microsoft philanthropic arm, Tech for Social Impact. But when it comes to commercializing this technology of AI and all the other products after we have proven that it can work,
yep.
I see a difference there. So the question first is to you, because I know that yet the social impact is not part of your KPI under the measurement for all the account manager here in Microsoft. So where do you see the conflict right now where commercializing and funding a prototype is two different things, and social impact is not yet part of your KPIs,
yep.
Where Kirsten just mentioned that any of this project or technology needs to have human and people at the core of it before the profit, right? So where do you see this conflict taking in Microsoft?
Yeah, no, thank you. Very, very good question. I think it's a complex one, and I think, interestingly, there's a fascinating experiment happening here in Australia, and I'll touch on that. And look, I will actually throw to Emma and Wayne on this, because I think they are living this experience more than I am. So the National Disability Insurance Scheme is such a fundamental shift in how disability services are provided to Australians with disabilities. It's having some teething issues, and I think everyone will acknowledge that. But it's the right thing to do, because it's creating a market for services and for products aimed at people with disabilities. I think the challenge we have at the moment in commercialising technology focused on people with disabilities is that marketplace. And so I think what we will see, hopefully, in Australia is as that program policy matures and the service delivery models are ironed out. I mean, I think the thing you have to acknowledge, and I know your solution, because it's providing into that disability service provision market, is such a fundamental shift for how those organisations operated. They would know, basically, for 12 months, here's how much money we have through philanthropic donations and from grants from government, and we'll just provide as many services as we can within that bucket. You flip that, so now the person with a disability is in control of the funding and what services they access. And so as a disability service provider, you've got to make that fundamental leap from being kind of having a very locked-in customer group to actually shifting, being much more commercially oriented, much more customer service focused. And that's been a massive challenge for the sector. And it's impacted on service delivery, and it's impacted on people with disabilities. But I think as we make that shift, and as the market matures, and as the service provision model matures, I think you'll find that Australia will be actually a really interesting test case of how that sort of commercial model can operate. And one of the things that I've been encouraging inside of Microsoft is to say, look, this is a growing opportunity. It's not quite there yet, but it will be. And we need to be ready to do that and support our partners to take us on that journey. So I might ask Emma and Wayne to also contribute to that, because they're kind of living it more than I am.
So. Do you want to go first?
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to add one brief thing, because I think you've summed it up excellently. And that is, well, firstly, that you're right. The service provision, disability service provision sector is having a really tough time coming to grips with a market-driven approach to disability care and support. Some of them, are grossly underprepared, frankly. And some of them are really embracing it and getting on with it and doing amazing things. The other side of that coin is that actually people with disability have a huge shift to make as well. Just to briefly give you an example of that, when I had my plan approved not so long ago, I was travelling to Melbourne for a work trip. And it wasn't Melbourne, it was Sydney. Anyway, for a work trip. And the night before, I was taking my daughter with me. And I thought, I have no idea what I'm going to do with this 11-year-old child for the afternoon. And normally, I would just sort of do what I could, use maps, figure out what I could. And I suddenly went, I can hire a support worker online tonight. And that's exactly what I did. I hired a support worker on the online platform. I got several messages. I could make up my mind right then and there which one I wanted to use, and there it was done. And I had a lovely afternoon sightseeing with my daughter. So it's a big shift for us as well to go, yes, we can actually ask for assistance. Yes, we're entitled to that support. We're entitled to make the choice about who provides that support and when it happens, whether it happens on the weekend or during the week. All of those things, it's just transformational for us, but it is also something that we're struggling with because many of us have had very low expectations of ourselves and have had our families and communities foist low expectations upon us. So it's a huge shift. And I think David's absolutely right. I think once it settles, once the dust settles, it's going to be an amazing system. But as I said, I am an optimist, so don't listen to me.
Well, I'm a bit of a cynic, but I agree with both David and Emma. I think it is a huge transformational change that we're going through in Australia. It's something that's never been done anywhere in the world, and there are going to be huge difficulties getting it right. But I think at the end of the day, it will be a really amazing transition. And I think, you know, the opportunities for businesses to create new products and services for people with disability is going to be there in ways that it was never there before.
If I could just quickly add,
sorry, Kristen.
I think the question was maybe had a different slant to it, which is how are these big tech companies actually going to change culture to actually, measure your performance on KPIs? I think that's what more the question was. And I think in a lot of startups actually do see, lots of marketing that goes around. We're building ethics panels and, things like that. And it's really, we're still, at the point of seeing, is it real or is it just marketing? And I think, Satya Nadella's written, this fantastic book, Reorient in Microsoft, and has done an amazing job of doing that. But ultimately, it comes all the way down to the people on the teams who need to be KPI'd on the stuff that you're talking about as well. So I think that's really where that was going. Sorry.
No, that's fine. No, thank you for keeping me honest. And look, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we're a measurement-driven organisation, and if we don't measure it, it hasn't happened. And I think we're sort of figuring out some of those metrics as we sort of go along and how we sort of reward people for behavioural change. I mean, I think you're right. There's been a massive cultural shift inside of Microsoft. We're not perfect, though. And in fact, there's been some recent reporting, which people will have seen, around some challenges inside of Microsoft for our female employees. But I think the difference I will say now, as opposed to maybe 5 years ago, is that we can actually have an open and honest and transparent conversation around that. And I think that's got to be the starting point. If you're not prepared to acknowledge those issues and acknowledge your fallibility, then you can't actually improve it. So no, thank you, Kirsten, for keeping me honest. Over here.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Gilad Rosner. I'm a privacy researcher visiting the University of Western Australia. Starting from the perspective that businesses not valuing profit and growth over other issues does not become the dominant operating mode. What regulatory interventions would you espouse when to change corporate behavior when their products could have a bias that would affect people's life chances, such as in lending, in prison sentencing, and in hiring?
Why don't I start, and I might. Wayne, you've got something you want to say?
Look, I don't know what the answer to that question is, but I think that is one of the really big questions that where all of these discussions are focusing on is how do we get to a place? What is the appropriate intervention in this area to make sure that the outcomes are good outcomes? And there's been a lot of discussion in the workshops that I've been in about, a regulatory model and an independent regulator. Do we have one? Do we have multiple? Are the regulators that we already have suitable to take it up in the sectors that they responsible for. I would suggest that a regulatory model is something that we need to relook at really hard. I think there's more than, well, there's plenty of examples of where, you know, the regulatory safeguards have failed consumers and failed society. I think, you know, the recent Royal Commission on Banking, the Royal Commission on Child Sexual Abuse, you know, there's just multiple, the area that I work in telecommunications, there's multiple areas where the current regulatory framework has not done the job that it was intended to do. So to go back down that road and say, okay, let's put in a regulatory intervention to make sure that AI protects society, it's just, I don't see that that's going to be the right way. I don't know what the answer is, but I think we need to think up some new interventions and new ways that actually will work whilst they, at the same time, they don't stifle innovation and progress and the benefits to society and the economy that can come from new technology.
And I think to pick up on Wayne's point, there's always a risk, particularly if you look at data protection and privacy rules, that you actually entrench the large players because you make the cost of complying with that regulation so high that it is only the large players that can actually meet those requirements. And I think Europe's starting to see some of that as a consequence of GDPR because the bar is so high to compliance that it is only companies like ourselves and Google can actually introduce those compliance measures. But then you also get into a conversation around the role of platforms. And so what we've sort of seen in technology is that there are these sort of increasingly dominant sort of cloud providers like ourselves and others. And then there's a potential benefit that can be driven by compliance from a large player into that community that builds on top of their systems. So it's got to be a nuanced conversation. It's got to be flexible. The concern is if government sort of moves too quickly in some of these spaces, there will be some unintended consequences. So we need to have a real conversation around it. So I think the next question's here.
G'day. Elliot Wood from Microsoft, actually. A bit of a question here, diving deeper into the regulations. So the panel, you know, do you have a view on whether the regulation should be applied at the data level, like the algorithm level, or the products and services provided? And I'd like to hear your views on that.
I agree with the panel, all the above. I mean, I think you've got to be very careful not to be too technologically specific in regulation because generally regulation is always going to move much at a much slower pace than technology will. But you do need to think of the implications that technology is having on human behaviour, on the impact on society, and I think we're having actually the conversation at the moment around technology and regulation is probably far different than it was 3 years ago, and I think even the sector is recognising that regulation actually is not a bad thing. Regulation is kind of needed because it sets the ground rules and then it provides the sort of the framework under which we can all develop, and it actually levels the playing field to a degree if it's done right, and you don't develop these unintended consequences that lock people out of the market. So,
yeah, I think the other thing about regulation is that it also does actually protect against some of the bias potentially that we've been talking about. You know, obviously it needs to be broad, and it needs to be, you know, fairly far-reaching, and obviously you can't have it on its own. You also need to do all the other things we've been talking about, like, you know, diversity in teams and all those sorts of things to make this work. And it's always better to have the carrot than the stick, isn't it? But the reality is we know that that without some sort of regulation, you know, someone's going to screw up somewhere, and it's, you know, we could all be in trouble. So I think it's a mix, and it's really challenging, I think, to get the right balance, but I wouldn't want to see a situation where, you know, it was so regulated that nothing got done and nothing got progressed. But I think the other interesting issue is around the privacy stuff. You know, the service I was talking about before, IRA, there are some real questions around that service and privacy. So, for example, if you're getting assistance with, you know, personal accessing personal documents, or if you're getting assistance with navigation to a particular location and that information is stored, or I don't know, you're going into a bank and doing a financial transaction. There are lots of questions that I don't think we've really answered sufficiently about privacy and how that is managed, and how we're all protected. I think that's a watch this space.
I'd just like to add, I think, you know, as the first response to your question was all of the above, I think that's very clear. We need to be across all of this different aspects of AI and how it works. But I think, you know, there's some sort of fundamental principles that need to be, embedded and used in whatever the methodology we use to protect against unintended consequences. And, you know, some of those would be, the right to redress, accountability. You know, is there some accountability for automated decisions that have bad outcomes? Is there a right of redress? You know, I think the fundamental one is that, you know, AI should do no harm is the first principle that needs to be embedded in whenever governance is used. I think the robo-debt incident in Australia was really a good example of how those things didn't work. It was a fully automated decision. There was no human intervention when potentially that could have been solved a lot of the problems. There was no real right for redress of people who found that they had been unfairly accused, I guess would be a term, of defrauding the government. There was no accountability. You know, the department and the government really struggled to take responsibility for that for quite a significant time. And those are the fundamental principles that are going to allow people to trust new technology, is when they know that if it goes bad, there's someone who can be accountable. There's a way for them to get redress and have a fundamental understanding that the technology is intended to cause no harm. But as Emma said, you know, there's always going to be incidents where things go wrong, you know, unexpectedly.
Got a question in the middle of the room here.
Yeah, I'm John Paulson from People, Passion and Performance. As you were talking, and I'd be interested in the panel's view, is a sort of potential win-win. The not-for-profit sector is suffering, you know, immensely at the moment from being able to raise funds both from government and the private sector. And I was thinking of NFPs that are really representing people with disabilities, or it might be providers of services themselves, being paid by developers and designers such as Microsoft to get their members and their people involved in actually looking at the bias and looking at how it works. And that could be a really nice model to, you know, solve two problems.
I'd be happy with that.
Yeah, it would be a great model.
And there is some of that happening already. I'd certainly encourage it. I mean, I think...
Yeah, there is some of it happening, but sometimes it's happening with service provision organisations rather than with consumer organisations. And it really is important that we make that distinction in the context of this conversation. And this is not in any way to denigrate the fantastic role of disability service providers, but they are not consumer representative bodies, and we do need to make that distinction. And when people are consulting, there can be scenarios where service providers can have conflicts of interest in terms of those negotiations or consultancy arrangements. And so I think the reality is that consumer representative bodies are the right places to have those conversations, to be honest. And I'm not saying that because I lead one. It's just about sensible practice and making sure that you're hearing the voices of people with disability rather than the people who serve them.
I think we have a question here.
Robin Waltall, Synergy. I'm interested in taking everything back to its smallest component, which is data. So if we look across history, humans have biased and skewed data to serve certain needs. So, and one of the ones that always springs to mind for me is the concept of fight and flight. So if you look at that original study, it was a group of men that they studied, and their reaction was fight and flight. If you looked at the same group that they studied a long time later, they looked at women. Women tend and befriend. So it's a different outcome, but if you use the wrong data set, obviously you're going to get aberrant or certain outcomes which may look perfectly okay to you but aren't. So I'm interested in, particularly when you were talking about the data component, how do we as organisations, one, get the focus to fix some of our data, which can be quite costly, the ability and the maturity to identify good data sets, and also to understand bias that's already there and also bias that might accumulate with that data and their algorithm over time?
I mean, for me, pretty much all these questions come down to leadership of the companies that are actually, you know, that are at the helm of the companies. So it's in the people that we hire, the teams. Again, we've talked about it a few times, it's diverse teams with a breadth of experience. I mean, we are now seeing in the US people who have philosophy degrees, anthropologists are now actually finding themselves, you know, some of the most important hires in Silicon Valley and all around now, when we're starting to actually understand that we need to understand people more broadly than individual data sets. So I think it's really, you know, just the leadership of the company. But I think that goes not just to how we build a tech team. I think that goes to everything that we do. We can't wait for government to come and regulate. We need leaders who actually regulate their own companies and actually tell their people what they expect of them and set the culture there. So that's how you get good data sets built and diverse teams and everything. It's actually the answer to everything. We can't wait for government. It will be 5 years because the problem is actually just too complex. You know, Wayne, you talked about it. What's ethical to me may not be ethical to someone else. Who is going to decide that? You know, we've had many years of being able to legislate manufacturing and all sorts of things, and that's what will eventually happen in AI. So it's, you know, it's a bit broad question, but I think first of all you've got to start with the leadership, and your leadership needs to understand technology. You can't put that to your CIO anymore. It is fundamentally, you must take the time to understand it. You don't need to know how to write code. Don't think I'm saying that. But understand how it's constructed and ask people to present it to their findings, you know, the tools that they've built to actually ingest data, measure it, train it, all of those things. These are things that they can actually show you and present to you. It's not, it doesn't have to be, you know, something that's over your head if you take the time to learn a little bit about it.
Yeah, and I think Wayne made a really good point about having humans involved in processes that affect other humans. Because one thing that machines are not very good at doing is that human intuition. If something doesn't feel right, it's a real human instinct. There's sort of this questioning nature of us, of humans, that we sort of look at something and go, either that feels, that's too simple, or it's wrong, or it just, I can't put my finger on it, but I'm going to go and quiz it a little bit more. And I think having that human involved in the process who is accountable for the outcome is really important. Because machines ultimately can't be. So I think we have a question back over here.
Thank you. Relevant affiliations are, I was previously chairman of Anglicare WA, a human services provider with 35,000 clients in the state, and I'm a co-founder and director of an artificial intelligence startup working in the medical technology arena. Firstly, I thank you to the eminent panel and the comments that you've made, and sincere commendation to CEDA and Microsoft for what I think is a very, very important forum. Not only for the sector, but for society. And I'd like to put the proposition that the disability sector cannot just be a recipient of this technology, but be a leader. And I'd like to pick up on something that I've seen, personally. I'm interested in the panel's comments around this, and it's not bias of data, algorithms or applications, it's bias within the organisations. And these are the service organisations that are servicing people with disabilities. And I speak from experience where I was chairing, And I was actually giving a talk last night, and two people on artificial intelligence, there was two people in the audience who were practitioners, eminent people, and they said, there is not a chance, both of these people said this, and I've seen this before, there is not a chance we would allow artificial intelligence and robots to be working with our people. And I reflect on that and Emma's comments about being reduced to tears through what Seeing AI has enabled her to do. And I think one of the great points of bias we have is within the sector, how do we educate the boards and the senior management to take the risks and trial this in ways that are not detrimental to people, but will accelerate for people with disability, but for people with society, society at large, people in society. Thank you.
Can I respond?
Yeah, no.
That's such an amazingly good question. Thank you. It's not dissimilar to the challenges we've had getting some disability service organisations to recognise that people with disability have the right to have support at the time of their choosing, not only between 9 and 5 on a Wednesday. It's not dissimilar to the challenges we sometimes have with trying to get, well, we always have, in fact, with trying to get people with disability into employment because of the attitudinal barriers that exist around that. And I actually think that's the answer to your question, is we need more people with disability on the boards of our service provider organisations, chairing the boards of our service provider organisations, in CEO and executive level roles. And I'm not actually just talking about within disability service organisations, although that was the point of your question, but I think that's how we get... We enable people with disability the dignity of risk. And it's extremely important that we are allowed to have the dignity of risk because, you know, everybody else is allowed to go and make a mistake or go and get run over by a bus or, well, hopefully not, but, you know, the only way we're going to get that change in society at large is to have more people with disability in leadership roles in our organisations across the board and in media. I'm a director on the board of the Attitude Foundation, and that organisation is attempting to improve media attitudes to people with disability. And it's the same issue. We just need more visibility. That's the only way we're going to change it. But thank you for your question. It's a great question.
Unfortunately, we have to have our final question. I'm sure a number of us will probably stick around, so feel free to grab us and have a follow-up conversation. But our last question's over here.
Andrew Campbell from Avizion. We're part of Worley Parsons. So I suppose I'm listening to this and hearing the disability angle to this, but I suppose my question's really around how do we frame the work in this space? How do we get the functional requirements down accurately enough to deal with bias? Now, it doesn't need to be bias in a disability sense, but, you know, in a technical sense where we play, you know, that's dollars and cents. So to me, what I hear is, you know, how do we have a framework to deal with, you know, the privacy data, but also the technical accuracy and let alone the IT implementation angles of this, which, you know, they say 95% of IT projects fail. And so to me, there's this general framework that's already out there, you know, the same way that we deal with workplace safety in a safety case point of view from an oil and gas point of view is no different from a self-regulation point of view that can be more agile and up-to-date. So I suppose my question here is, how is this really different from the disability space to what we do in heavy industry for our oil and gas clients, our mining clients, even our infrastructure clients that, you know, give us water on a daily basis? So I suppose it's how do we have a framework to get this technology out there for the greater good ultimately. So I'd like your thoughts on that.
Look, I'll make some comments and I'll pass to the panel. I think the thing that we can do now that we haven't been able to do in the past is fail quickly and fail safely. I think it's through a combination of using sort of cloud services and using, you know, virtual reality or simulation or whatever it might be, you can test things in a fairly cheap and cost-effective sort of way that you couldn't do in the past. And I think if you look at the old sort of IT approach, the sort of waterfall projects, where it would take you so long to realise the benefit that you'd already invested millions and millions of dollars in the outcome and you were kind of locked into that approach. You can test things now and you can try it and you can see whether it's going to work or whether it's not going to work, and you can test for some of the biases earlier on in the process rather than get so far down the end of that project that you're too far gone to come back. So that would be my starting point, but I'll throw to the panel. They agree. So.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I think that the key in that answer from David was the fail-safe aspect. You know, we need to make sure that there is no detriment to, you know, to society in these iterations of getting products and services to market. And there was a great presentation at the Blind Citizens Convention a couple of weeks ago from Ed Santo, the Human Rights Commissioner, talking about, you know, the idea of putting product to market, the MVP, as it's called apparently, which is the most viable product, the easiest and quickest product to get out to the market. You know, in the context of AI and you know, some of, you know, worst case scenarios, the inherent problems with that is that it's going to have significant impact on people's lives, and we can't afford to take that approach unless it's a fail-safe approach where people don't get hurt.
Yeah. Agree. Thank you, Paula. We'll hand back to you to wrap us up.